Good morning. So here we are towards the end of Rohatsu Sesshin. The weather's going to be a little chilly and overcast. It'll help encourage us to keep our energies close in our bodies and in the Zendo. I have the body I have now on this day of Sesshin is familiar to me. I think I'll call it Sesshin body. I'm aware of a lot of parts of my body, mainly limbs and my musculoskeletal system, that I'm usually not so aware of. We've been using our bodies completely and fully in Sesshin, with full effort. It takes all of that to do a Sesshin of this length and intensity. I've never been a real athlete in my life, and I know athletes maybe over and over are able to judge the full intensity that they put in their sport. A marathon runner really has to know exactly what his body is doing mile after mile to be able to get those 26 miles in. I judge my intensity of body practice by what I know about Sesshin. And when I do an activity like hiking or traveling that I know I'm putting in all of my body and mind, I say, you know, this is just like Sesshin. I know that I've focused everything I've got into this activity, the whole works. And and if it doesn't quite feel like that, I know that I've got a few more miles in me, that I can get back into my body and mind and still go a few miles. I've talked a lot about developing trust and confidence in the big mind, confidence in big mind. During Sesshin, I kind of developed confidence first in this Sashin body, in the history of my being a Zen student. Certainly, in early Sashins, there were times that I didn't think I could finish. I knew that I'd signed up for the 2 or the 3 or the 5 days. We rarely did 7 days in the early days of practice here with Catherine. I didn't know what my body could do in Sashin. Even though it's just sitting, we all know that, you know, after a few periods or after a couple of days in Sashin, that we're going to have to take a close look at how we use this body. And it might, I'm not so sure, I don't have the confidence that this body, even just sitting like this, or moving back and forth to a chair, or changing my posture, I'm not sure this body is going to be able to maintain this posture and attitude of Buddha for these next few hours or these next couple of days. I had to gain some confidence. I might be able to say at this point that those early sashins for me were all about my body and learning about it and what it could do. I wasn't so used to checking out my body. It kind of did what I wanted it to do always. You know, in those days, all my body really had to do was be able to hold a book up or be able to, you know, sit for a while in front of a keyboard. I did play a little tennis in high school. But I didn't know about my body. So it's funny, I don't know why I thought it mattered. I certainly didn't walk through the door here the first time to learn about my body the way, you know, probably, you know, all the gyms that I've been to or and joined. When I walk in the door, I have this idea when I go to the gym that I'm going to learn about my body. And so I don't think that was the deal when I came to 115 School Street and walked through the door, that I was going to learn about my body or that it was important to learn about my body. Because I just lived near here, it was the handiest for me to come to the morning sits. And so I would do that a few times a week. And right away it was about, you know, the waking up, setting the alarm, and what this body felt like coming here. So that was a clue, even though my body only had to sit in this posture for one period before I went home. Within a few months, I think I started coming here in February, in either June or July of 93, was the first weekend sashin, and we did the sashins in those days up at Jikoji. So I remember it being very warm, and that we went there on a Friday afternoon so that we could get there for dinner. And we sat a couple of periods Friday night, And then all day from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. Saturday, and then 5 a.m. till about 3 in the afternoon is when the sesshins would break up. And so I don't know why it was important for me to learn about my body. I can't remember. I mean, Catherine always spoke about staying in the body and staying in the breath. And we sitting here now, you know, having been chanting about, staying in this skin bag, in the poem that we've been reciting in the evening, we all know that this practice is about this body and mind, body/mind. But I don't know when I first started hearing that, because like I say, coming here, I didn't think it was about a body practice. But it was important for me to learn about my body, especially late in the day when it was hard to get through each 40-minute period. And I had amazing strategies with two or three different postures that I could assume. You know, if I could squeeze out 40 minutes in one posture, then the next period I would start with another posture and squeeze that one out. So I had two or three maneuvers. And then those last two at night, even when it was, actually that first sesshin, there was nothing cool about Jikoji in any part of the day in those summertime sesshins, but then we would do fall and winter that same year, and no matter how cool it was in the zendo or how we'd, you know, maybe complain, usually just to ourselves, about how cold it was, there was nothing cold those in the evening time, you know, when I was really trying to get through those last couple of periods and sweat was beating on my brow and no jaws could have been clenched more tightly. And I would say things to myself like, okay, I can get through 10 more breaths until I change my posture. And those were kind of the maneuvers. And you know, I don't want to recommend that to anybody, but knowing that I could do 10 more breaths and then maybe 10 more, and then, you know, when the bell would ring, you know, get up and walk up the muddy stairs to the dormitory was confidence building. It might not have been the inconceivability of non-dual consciousness, but it was confidence building. So here was actually sitting that would build confidence. It wasn't just confidence. I mean, what kind of a skill is sitting sesshin anyway? I mean, it didn't give me a pay raise. Let me tell you, what kind of a skill is that? It was just getting to know my body. It was, you know, certainly Zen is about the whole works and limitlessness. You know, not just here to here, and ultimately not even here to here. So Zen has those terms to it. So it was just It was just getting to know this body and how to practice. And many, many of us in my era, sitting here with Catherine in the 90s, have said how grateful we are to this practice and to Catherine for constantly pointing to our bodies, pointing us to our bodies. So I know there's a connection between confidence building in mind and body and this sitting. And then of course it made real sense when Catherine would talk about being totally exhausted by her mind and not being able to come to any resolution or any peace, or not being able to let go of something that was just swarming about. And she would turn to her body then, just any part of her body that required any focus. And she said, she didn't really feel that, if she was having knee pain, that it had anything to do with what she was thinking. But to bring some attention down to the knee, or straightening the posture, she said, felt integrate the energy that was so stuck up here. And so body practice was revealed to Catherine in that way, and she gave us those practices too on just get back to your body. It's nothing special. It's not anything to do with where your head difficulties are, but can you be in your whole body? So I've got some confidence in my body, and that doesn't mean that it's pain-free. It means I know where I am. I know where my body is on day 6 now of this sesshin. I've got a few more periods of meditation. I won't go there. I won't go there. I've got a few more periods of meditation in me, and it feels like the whole works are in gear. This body, this mind, this heart, and I'm grateful for this practice. I think this practice of, a schedule of sitting and walking from the early morning to late at night, with meal practice that also keeps us in our body, with on the breaks where we're to do appropriate care of our body and mind, but still staying in body and mind with some attention. I'm really grateful for this practice. I think this really is a practice, as Suzuki said, about my life and the activities in my life. And I wouldn't approach my life or know my life the way I do without this practice that seems that seems kind of different than my life, but I think everybody sitting here knows that that this practice is not separate from our life, and as many teachers have said, Zazen is our life. So for this I express great gratitude. The last of the four practices that lead us to the path taught by Bodhidharma is called suffering injustice. Out. When those who search for the path encounter adversity, they should think to themselves, in countless ages gone by, I've turned from the essential to the trivial, and wandered through all manner of existence, often angry without cause and guilty of numberless transgressions. I've turned from the essential to the trivial and wandered through all manner of existence, often angry without cause. That goes together. Often angry when I shouldn't be, or and guilty of numberless transgressions. Now, though I do no wrong, I'm punished by my past. Neither gods nor men can foresee when an evil deed will bear its fruit. I accept it with an open heart and without complaint of injustice. The sutras say, when you meet with adversity, don't be upset because it makes sense. With such understanding, you're in harmony with your mind. And by suffering injustice, you enter the path. Those are kind of tough words. I don't have any great insights on karma, which is a central teaching in our religion. This almost implies that it's out there looking for me, waiting to catch up. I don't quite think that's how it works. One practice that one thing that I try to abide in times of adversity that helps unblock me from blame or shame or anger is I try to say, oh, this is the perfect expression of all of the causes and conditions that are arising right now. That helps me move somehow when I look at anything in the world or anything in my life and break it down into an inconceivable causes and conditions. I say, oh, it couldn't have happened any other way. And I can at least move towards relieving suffering, perhaps. or towards you know, this whole idea of suffering and justice reminds me of patience and forbearance. I can at least sit still or stand still or bear this or take 10 more breaths with this. That idea helps me. I don't think that's exactly karma, but I think it helps me to think, to break things down into causes and conditions and see that, oh, it can't happen any other way. I think of all the car rides that I've taken and driven over my decades. And so I know I've got some petroleum product karma that is coming to fruition right now, that is bearing fruit. I drove here today, as many of us did, and so I understand that connection. I actually appreciate the beauty of the cars of my youth, Studebakers and Ramblers in particular, and I think they were beautiful, and I think the internal combustion engine was somehow given to us by the muses. It's an angelic invention, and yet there's a pretty clear line between the beauty of the auto or love affair, especially in America, with the automobile and petroleum products, that really has us right here on the cliff's edge. And I fully avow. This is also a time to look at our ancient twisted karma regarding racism and sexism. They both go back to the beginning, the dawn of humans, a million years. Racism and sexism are in our bones. The half-life is exceedingly long. It's still in the foreground of our culture. How do we look at this type of attitude and posture that is so subtle, and not even so subtle sometimes, but so deep and coming out in so many ways. As I think I said another time, I know that a story appears in my head just talking to a man or a woman. I've got a gender story that precedes the first words of our conversation, that that the dialogue gets filtered through. There's another story, when meeting a person of color, that dialogue gets filtered through a story already in my head. And how do I practice with that? How do I practice with that other than to avow this ancient twisted karma and to look for any little practice that can help me from causing repeated suffering? Can I pay attention to who has spoken in a group, in a meeting, and can I make sure that in my mind that all voices have been heard? Can I watch my impulse to jump in a conversation and pay attention to who exactly do I feel comfortable jumping in? Or am I jumping in now because I feel comfortable because of the gender or race of the person that was speaking? Those are practices I've looked at, and also just knowing that, how many times over the years, because of my white privilege and male privilege, that the outcome of an interaction has been a disparity in power and rank, with me being higher than another person. How can I practice with this, other than to keep it on the front burner, to be aware that with everyone I've got this story already in my head, based on many things. This article, or this interview with Ijoma Olu, who is an African American writer from Texas, the interviewer says to her, "You believe that if you're white in America, you're racist, and if you're a male in America, you're sexist. Are you saying I can't," the interviewer is a white male, "are you saying I can't transcend my received culture no matter what kind of a person I am?" Olu replies, "I don't think you can escape it, but that doesn't mean you can't fight racism or patriarchy. You can fight the racism in society even while you fight the racism inside you. It's like fighting a cancer inside you. You're not pro-cancer because you have it. There's no way to avoid absorbing our American culture, which was designed to benefit white males. We absorb American racism in ways we're not fully aware of. You can't undo a lifetime of experience in a few years of work. While you are struggling with racism, the culture keeps reinforcing it, telling you who is normal and who isn't, who deserves to be seen and who is made invisible. Racism is alive." In this country, there are large racial divides in everything from infant mortality to how much you earn to your chances of being arrested or incarcerated. This is not because a bunch of white people wake up every day and decide to oppress people of color. It's not just the actions of individuals with hate in their hearts. We cannot understand American racism unless we recognize it as a system that was built to run and still runs on principles of oppression and domination. 400 years of history can't go back into the toothpaste tube. So I think our practice is laid out for us to go in deeply to those very deep habits that keep coming up again and again, causing us suffering, causing others suffering. This is our practice, of course, and we need to know the breadth of our practice, that we can also practice with these very deep, ancient, twisted karmic patterns that we sometimes don't know how to access, we need to be open for others to show us how these karmic patterns are now revealed in us, and keep this on the front grill of that old Studebaker, so that we know it's there, so that we know it's there and can continually practice with this ancient twisted karma, with our ancient, well-loved practice that we know relieves us from suffering and liberates ourself and others. I think our sexism and racism is a great example of karma that we have inherited over this lifetime and many lifetimes, that bears fruition in ways that we don't know and are just now beginning to know. This is what our practice calls on us to do, to practice with our skin, with our flesh, with our bones, and with our marrow, to save all beings and relieve ourselves from suffering. I've brought Gary Snyder's Mountains and Rivers Without End to each one of these lectures, thinking that there'd be time to read or an appropriate time. I've got no favorite poem. It's a great book, and some of us had the opportunity to see Gary Snyder just a couple of weeks ago, reading up at up at UCSC. He's 87 years old and a cancer survivor, and his wife died recently, and he looks the same as this picture that was probably taken, 30 years ago. He's a humble guy. He said that he read a poem in Ferlinghetti's bookstore one night that nobody remembers because the next poet was Allen Ginsberg, who howled through the night. So he read that poem, and it was pretty good. And there was no reason for him to feel bad about it. But I just found a piece, like a lot of his poems, they're wonderful images. There's no place to land, really. It's just image after image. And I think it mirrors our practice of can I look at this? Can I look at this briefly? Is this too hard to look at? And whether it's easy or hard to look at, knowing that there's no place to take it for a landing, we just have to take that in into our hearts and see if it can't be integrated somehow in a very different way, such that its expression no longer causes the suffering. This one's called The Blue Sky. Eastward from here, beyond Buddha worlds 10 times as numerous as the sands of the Ganges, there is a world called pure as lapis lazuli. Its Buddha is called Master of Healing, Azure Radiance Tathagata. It would take you 12,000 summer vacations driving a car due east all day, every day, to reach the edge of the lapis lazuli realm of Medicine Old Man Buddha, east Old Man realm, east across the sea, yellow sand land, Coyote Old Man land, silver and stone blue. Blue, sky colors of the flames, Flamen, Brahman, Beltane, blue fire, sky, the dappled cloud zone, Sanskrit skew covered, skewed, pied, skew ball, stew ball, skyball, piebald, horse with lightning feet, a mane like distant rain, the turquoise horse, a black star for an eye, white shell teeth, pony that feeds on the pollen of flowers, may thee whole, heal, hail, whole, the spell of the Master of Healing. Namu Bhagavate Vaishaya Guru Daiturya. I honor the Lord, the Master of Healing, shining like lapis lazuli, the King, the Tathagata, the Saint, the perfectly enlightened one, saying, Om to the healing, to the healing, to the healer. Hail. Svaha. His years of Buddhist practice are right on the front grill of that rambler. May we heal. May we heal this planet. May we heal our hearts. May we heal our minds. May we know the wholeness of healing. Om Svaha. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.